Let's start, for I think obvious reasons, with the theme that we've continued to see. That in many ways we see come to a culmination in the text that Tracy just read for us, which is the theme of discipleship failure. Okay, so we say a lot at Gospel Life Church, and we've repeated it a lot these last few weeks because this is the theme that we've been in together, that every discipleship failure is ultimately a failure to, in some way, believe or understand or apply the good news of Jesus, the gospel. And this is the case even on the extremes. What do I mean by that? Well, okay, so people like Bob Thune, Will Walker in The Gospel-Centered Life, which is a text that we use a lot here at Gospel Life Church, or Tim Keller in his short article, his PDF, The Centrality of the Gospel, which we include in our church membership materials here at GLC also. Both of them extensively write on the issues, the problems in the Christian life of moralism and relativism, religion, irreligion, okay? And in a lot of ways, these two realities of moralism or religion on the one hand, and legalism, and license, irreligion, secularism on the other hand, man, these seem like polar opposites because you have, on the one hand, legalism, a religiosity, a belief that you can somehow earn God's favor through how you act and what you do, okay? And then you have license or secularism, a belief that you should just be able to do whatever you want to do. Respond however you want to respond. Rules don't really matter, except for the rules that you make for yourself. Okay? And so you have these two issues that are regular issues from within life. And yet Thune and Keller both write about how they're actually, though they look like they're on the extreme opposite ends, I mean, even the names like religion, irreligion, they both share the same source. And we employ them for the same purpose. Okay, so Keller writes it this way. He says, they seem so different, but from the viewpoint of the gospel, they're really the same. They're both ways to avoid Jesus as Savior and keep control of their own lives. Irreligious people seek to be their own saviors and lords through irreligion, worldly pride. No one tells me how to live or what to do, so I determine what's right and wrong for me. But moral and religious people seek to be their own saviors and lords through religion, religious pride. I am more moral and spiritual than other people, so God owes me. So the irreligious person rejects Jesus entirely, but the religious person only uses Jesus. These are two different ways to do the same thing, right? Two different ways to do the same thing. Control our own lives. Two responses that appear so polar opposite, actually, from the viewpoint of the gospel, are the same. They stem from the same root. They're employed for the same cause. And we see that exact same issue unfolding in John's account now because Peter, you know, just moments before this text. So from last week's text to this week's text, we see two responses from Peter that in similar ways to religion and irreligion seem like polar opposites, right? So last week, just moments, again, so it's a week in our reading, but just moments in the text, moments in the narrative. Leapt in front of Jesus with a dagger, perhaps out of a desire to share or prove his worth to Jesus, perhaps out of a belief that this was the moment the Messiah would come to begin the war to defeat the nations, probably a little bit of both. And from this central misunderstanding of gospel, he cuts off the ear of the servant, you know, in what seems like, on the one hand, apparent boldness. So you have this, like, response from Peter that looks very bold moments beforehand, and now this morning, you have denial. It's polar opposite. What Peter looks like in this morning's text cannot be described as boldness, and yet on closer examination, we see that both responses share the same root and are employed for the same reason. And we'll also see what that means for us as believers in terms of our growth as Christians, because on the one hand, it's hard to deny that the commands of Jesus, the commands of God to his people are important. They're significant. You know, Norm's call to worship was so appropriate to our text because it grounds us in this reality that we're called to abide in Jesus, that we're called to keep his commandments. But what happens when we can't do it? You know, what happens when we fail? So how do we grow in those commandments? How do we take them seriously on the one hand, and yet at the same time realize this isn't something that I'm able to accomplish? Like, what does that look like? What does this Christian growth look like? Well, we'll see this in three sections of the narrative, for sure. But there's a contrast that John really sets out here, a Christ-centered contrast. So we'll see John set out this one big contrast in these three parts with three questioners in the text. Three rounds of questioning with three responses. And if this doesn't make sense now, I think it'll make more sense as we dive into the text rather than me explaining it all up front. So let's just look at verses 15 through 17. Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. Since that disciple was known to the high priest, he entered with Jesus into the courtyard of the high priest, but Peter stood outside at the door. So the disciple who was known to the high priest went out and spoke to the servant girl who kept watch at the door and brought Peter in. The servant girl at the door said to Peter, "You also are not one of this man's disciples, are you?" So here we see the first round of questioning. So here we see the first round. A servant girl confronts Peter, okay? A servant girl confronts Peter. This girl plays the role of being the first of three questioners. So let's back up first and get some context. If we remember from last week, Jesus has been arrested, he's been bound. Really, the better description of what's happened is that he's given himself up for arrest because he's demonstrated his power over the Roman forces, that he's calling the shots, right? That nobody could take him captive without his consent, that he's in control over the entire situation. And if you have questions about that, go back and listen to last week's text. And then as we looked at verses 12 through 14, and you can look there now as a refresher, we see this evidence that this detachment of Roman soldiers accompanied these Jewish officers, right, to put down any possible revolt. They took action. You know, this band of soldiers apparently sought to put an end to this possible havoc started by Peter when he wielded his dagger against the servant. So they quickly bind and bring Jesus to the place where Annas is. But it's also very much, it appears that now that the disciples have scattered, these Roman authorities have concluded, these Roman soldiers have concluded that the threat has diminished, it's been neutralized, so they go back to their barracks, most likely in the fortress of Antonia. And so now Jesus is led by Jewish officers first to Annas in those verses 12 through 14. That's where we left off. Okay, who's Annas? Annas was the father-in-law of the high priest Caiaphas, okay? But he himself was actually high priest roughly 15 to 20 years before these events that we're reading about now took place. So 15 to 20 years prior to that, he was high priest. He would have sons that would go on to become high priest, including his son-in-law, Caiaphas. So you need to understand, this is really a power family. Okay, in Israel during the time, it's almost like in the U.S., we've had families where it's like multiple presidents come from that family and governors and people who, whether they're connected directly or they're in-laws, they hold high offices all in this one family. This is what's happening here. Okay, it's a very powerful family in first century Israel. And we'll talk about what he's up to in just a little bit. So picking back up in our text this morning, Peter and another disciple follow Jesus to the courtyard of the high priest. I don't want to spend a ton of time here related to the identity of this other disciple. Strictly speaking, we can't know for sure. The best we can do is tentatively make some kind of a decision. I think there are some clues here that would lead me to adopt with some level of confidence that the traditional interpretation is correct, which is that this is John, all right? And there are pushbacks that people have. I had three paragraphs. They're gone, okay? So you can come up to me and ask me about it later. But there are pushbacks that are given here that I don't think actually are reason enough, like he has an inn with the high priest, what, a fisherman from Galilee? Yes, okay, it was common. So There are problems that are posed that I don't think are real problems to this being John. There are textual reasons that I think it's likely to be John, and there are reasons why other people don't quite fit here. Nevertheless, we can't know for sure. So this unnamed disciple, what one thing we do know for sure is he comes and he puts a word in for Peter at the gate. Okay, so Peter's not known in this context, but this other disciple is known. Okay, and a servant girl is keeping watch, which, by the way, is further evidence of the historicity of the gospel account here. The fact that at the very least, you know, if you're reading through this account and you're trying to figure out, like, if you're a skeptic of Christianity or if you're not sure what you believe about this, you're trying to think, like, okay, what aspects of this is historical or not? Like, when you come across details like this, I think this is evidence of, at the very least, the person who's writing believes that this happened in this way, because this was just not typical. Typically, a man would be the one tasked with watching the gate. Definitely not a servant girl. Her testimony wouldn't have even been allowed admissible into a court of law. So if you were just, if this account was being invented whole cloth 100 years later by Greek-speaking writers who had never set foot in Palestine, like Bart Ehrman claims, this would not be something they would include, you know? This would not be something that they would invent or make up, because it was just so out of line with the culture of the time. It was so abnormal. And yet, here we see that apparently, when Caiaphas was high priest, the task was given at times to this young woman. So, upon entering, the servant girl now questions Peter. She's our first questioner of the text. You also are not one of this man's disciples, are you? You know, so again, the "you also" part of the text indicates that she recognizes the other disciple as being someone who's regularly been with Jesus. She appears to know him, she recognizes him, and recognizes him as someone who's just with him a lot. I think this gives more evidence to the fact that this is probably John, okay? Credibility, that's one of the 12. But the question itself is phrased, I think, really well in the ESV. And Tracy just nailed the tone of it, because some of the other translations say things like, you know, "Are you another of this man's disciples?" Which sounds like it could be taken conversationally, like, oh, you're another, okay, tell me about that. How's that going? You know, like, but no, this isn't neutral. It's pretty clear in the context. It's disdainful. It's a little snarky. Oh no, not another one. You know, it's almost more of an assertion or an accusation than it is a question at this point. And so that's where we move now from the understanding that, right, is where we move from the first round of questioning. This servant girl confronts Peter, to now the first response. Peter is fearful and denies Jesus. Look at verses 17 and 18, the rest of 17 and into 18. He said, "I am not." Now the servants and officers had made a charcoal fire because it was cold, and they were standing and warming themselves. Peter also was with them, standing and warming himself. Okay, so maybe the tone of her question intimidates Peter a little bit. In fact, the further we get along in the text, the more that will become clear, that is in fact what's happening. Also, perhaps Peter is thinking, well, look, if I admit this, they'll throw me out of the courtyard, you know? So I'd better keep it quiet so that I can stay here. And so I think the context pretty strongly suggests the way those two things work together is that Peter is indeed intimidated by these questions and this line of questioning, something we'll continue to see evidence for, but that Peter could have perhaps been justifying the way he was answering this question, at least in the first, by claiming it to be strategic. Hey, I don't want to get thrown out. Then I don't even get to be close to Jesus here. You know, then I lose all credibility as someone who can stand in this courtyard. So like Jesus gets it, I need to kind of be incognito a little bit. And there's a way we can do this today, right? There's a way that even today, we can be intimidated by surrounding culture. You know, and I'm talking about me too, right? We can be intimidated, whether it's in the workplace, whether it's in our neighborhood, like family groups that meet, your kids play sports, and so you're hanging out with other parents, you're in a mom's group in your neighborhood or whatever, right? And you know, based on things that you've heard and things that you've experienced, how most people in your neighborhood view Christians, especially those who hold to the ethics of Jesus, the ethics of Scripture, right? And so there's some intimidation. Like, we can decide not to be bold in our witness, you know, not to share really anything about that part of our lives, which, if we're actually believers, it's central to everything about us, you know, like, so we can hide what is central, all the while claiming that strategy is the reason. You know, we can kind of justify it to ourselves. And again, I'm talking about me here too. We can justify it. Well, if people think I'm weird, you know, they won't like me. If people think I'm weird, you know, like, they won't talk to me. My reputation will be frowned upon. I won't have a platform from which to like, be on mission. But if we're honest with ourselves, like Peter in this context, the actual reason isn't strategy. It's intimidation. You know, it's that we don't want others to think we're weird. You know, we don't want the social consequences of claiming Jesus. Just as Peter does not want the consequences in this moment of claiming Jesus. So we can sometimes position ourselves as those who either don't talk much about the gospel, or we even, like, we join in the mocking of evangelical culture, you know? We join in the mocking of those who are Christians to a certain extent alongside of culture in order to somehow win the culture. We justify it as, like, well, this is how I'm going to get them to like me. And there can sometimes even be a high and mighty posture associated with those kinds of attempts, when it's actually because we're often ashamed, you know. So Peter fearfully denies. He demonstrates fear, faithlessness. You know, the other disciple, he's also been outed as a disciple. Do you notice this in the text? But notice that he's not falling all over himself in an effort to deny it. Why? Not because he's better, not because he's stronger, but it's because he's more comfortable in this situation. He feels like he feels like he has less to lose. Like, he doesn't think, he's known here, he's comfortable here. He does not think that the people who are here will seek any kind of immediate retribution against him, at the very least in this moment. But Peter, he doesn't have any of that. He's very vulnerable. He responds in fear and faithlessness. And it's immediately after Peter denies Jesus in this way that John now shares the setting of the courtyard. You know, because at this point, just to make sure we all understand, the furthest we've gotten in the text is in the gate, you know, like John's put a word in and she's opened it. And so as she's like opening the gate, it's like, wait, not you too. And that's as far as we've gotten before a denial has taken place. So now he denies, Peter walks into the courtyard, and so now he sees there's this fire. There are people who are warming themselves around the fire. A couple of things to note about this fire in the courtyard. First, it would be unusual for proceedings like this to happen at night. And we need to know that. We need to know that for the next couple of weeks. Whatever is happening here appears to be happening under the cover of darkness for a reason. Okay? There's a legality issue, I think. And Jesus is actually going to hint at it. He's going to draw our attention to it. He's going to poke at it right here in the text. But second, so the fact that they're gathered around a fire by night to warm themselves while proceedings are happening inside, it's unusual. But second, make a quick mental note of this term, charcoal fire. You know, again, I think the ESV gets it very right. They don't translate it simply as fire, a fire that they're standing around. But they specify the kind of fire, which is good because this is a unique word. There are many words that John could have used for fire, but he specifies a very specific type. Burning coals were often used for warmth and cooking. This word is only used twice in all of John's gospel account. This is the first of two times. And if you remember how John likes to use words to express both historical events but also unearth something a little bit deeper and make broader connections, by the time we get to the second charcoal fire, we're going to see a really significant connection, okay? Which I don't want to say too much about now, but I think it's intended to draw memories back to this place in a very real and tangible way. So, having painted the picture for us well, John now changes settings, which is unique You know? So John's telling this story. He's telling the story about something that's happening with Peter. The servant girl lets him in. As she does so, she questions him. He denies it. There's this group of people, charcoal fire, end scene. Let's go inside now to what's happening. A second round of questioning. Number two, we're now, second questioner, Annas interrogates Jesus. Look at verse 19. The high priest then questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. So, as I said earlier, Annas was former high priest, much like, you know, a professor at a university would be like professor emeritus, or even you have like pastor emeritus at some churches where it's like the former pastor still kind of hangs out there. Everybody calls him pastor. He doesn't really have any authority to do much, but he's pastor emeritus. Annas is kind of a high priest emeritus, except he still does have a lot of authority. You know, like I said, it's a power family, so he's undoubtedly an advisor, the former high priest whose sons have been high priest, whose son-in-law is the high priest. He's an advisor, a political advisor in a way, to his son-in-law who has this highest office in the Sanhedrin. And so undoubtedly he's conspired with his son-in-law. And you know, he's told them, Caiaphas, you know, if we do this right, we can have this, like, let's think about this. We have this opening gambit, like we're playing a game of chess. Here's the opening move. Here's the introduction move, okay? The idea here is, let me question Jesus. Let me just, before the trial in the Sanhedrin, just bring him quietly before me. I'll gain information before the trial, and then I can bear witness. Like, who would be a better witness at a trial of the Sanhedrin, like a more respected eyewitness who could come and claim testimony against Jesus, than the former high priest, who's one of the most powerful people in all of Israel, right? So we have to understand that when Jesus is arrested and bound and brought, the typical way this would have been done would have been no questioning, no trial, until he's able to come before the Sanhedrin. In fact, there are many, even in the first century, who would have said it is illegal. Like, the proper interpretation of Mishnah is that it is illegal to question the defendant. There's some rights there, and we're going to get into that a little bit. But so the idea here is that Annas wants to do some preliminary, let's just get some information out of him. Maybe he'll let some things slip, okay, that we can use before the Sanhedrin. So he questions Jesus specifically about two things. Look at verse 19, his disciples and his teachings. So he wants to know about his disciples, those who followed him, attempting to find out about any conspiracy happening where Jesus is secretly leading an army against Rome, the identity of any co-conspirators. Like, Jesus has this public ministry, but then privately he's stirring up all this trouble. Then he also questions him about his teaching, and at the root of that is obviously the claims that Jesus has made about himself that has caused the religious leaders to even desire to pick up stones to stone him, to put him to death, to arrest him in the past. Okay, so he's trying to get Jesus to admit either conspiracy against Rome, blasphemy in his teachings, or ideally, both. So then he can give testimony about what Jesus said, present evidence, but the gambit fails. Because here we see the second response, where Peter is fearful and denies Jesus in the first response. You see the exact opposite here. The second response, Jesus is faithful and denies nothing. He's faithful and denies nothing. Verses 20 to 24. Jesus answered him, I've spoken openly to the world. I've always taught in synagogues and in the temple where all Jews come together. I've said nothing in secret. Why do you ask me? All those who have heard me, ask those who have heard me what I said to them. They know what I said. When he said these things, one of the officers standing by struck Jesus with his hand, saying, is that how you answer the high priest? Jesus answered him, if what I said is wrong, bear witness about the wrong. But if what I said is right, why do you strike me? Annas then sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. So Jesus responds by denying nothing of what he's said before. In other words, he doesn't try to walk back claims that he's made. He's not trying to smooth things over. He's like, that's not what I meant. He's not trying to clarify, you know, anything. He says there is no difference between what he has taught his disciples and what he's taught in public, and he denies nothing that he's taught. There's not some secret conspiracy. You know, when it says, I have said nothing in secret, he's not saying that there weren't times that he was with his disciples teaching in a more like private setting, going into more depth what he had been teaching. What he's saying is, look, the central message I declared to them is the same central message I declared to the people. There is no difference between the message. This is the same. So Jesus says, go ask them. And you know, so it's a way of pointing out that there's no difference, but and it's a way of pointing out like his consistency, but this is also a way of poking the problem that's occurring here, rightly shaming Annas a bit, because in a trial in which a defendant is bound, again, he's to be brought before the Sanhedrin. There's kind of a Fifth Amendment in place in which, again, it may have even been illegal to question the defendant. If you were to prove someone guilty before the Sanhedrin, like today, you needed to present evidence and witness testimony against them. You couldn't just make up something whole cloth and question the defendant. All right. In this case, they attempt to get around this rule by taking him to Annas informally so that there's kind of plausible deniability here. And if it doesn't work out, Annas can say, oh, we were just talking, we were waiting for the trial. If he gives them something, he can say, well, we were just waiting for the trial, but you should hear what Jesus was going on and on about, right? So that was the attempt here, but Jesus has them. He points it out, and they know it. So there's kind of an anger and outrage. He's struck in the face, kind of weak reasoning. Is that how you answer the high priest? And Jesus doesn't back down. He's not fearful. He's in control. He simply responds, if what I said is wrong, show it, like, show the wrong. Deal with the wrong. Show evidence. If what I said is right, if what I said is true, why do you hit me? And in saying that, he shows the reason they hit him. It's because they know he's right. So Annas sees the gambit has failed, that things could be, get out of control a bit. There's nothing that Annas now has to gain by pushing this forward, and in fact, he might be fearful that there's much to lose. So he, okay, that's it. And he sends them off, sends Jesus off to Caiaphas. So look at the contrast between these two so far. You know, the first and second questions and responses, right? Because you have this opening round of questioning from a servant girl. A servant girl who, like I said, because of the way in which first century Jewish culture and custom viewed women, her testimony, both as a servant and as a woman, would not have been admissible before the Sanhedrin. So you have the servant girl questioning Peter at a gate, not in a group of, not in any kind of like proceedings inside, but just in the courtyard. And he responds in fear. Peter is fearful and he denies Jesus. But then you have the second and far more serious round of questioning from one of the most powerful people in Israel, in which Jesus is faithful and denies nothing. And now to reinforce that contrast, so okay, now we go right back outside to Peter again to pick up right where we left off. Here's where we see the third round of questioning. Okay, the third round. A group of people question Peter. Starting in verse 25. Now Simon Peter was standing and warming himself. So again, they're around this charcoal fire, standing and warming themselves. So they said to him, you also are not one of his disciples, are you? And again, you know, we see, I think, the exact same question, the exact same tone from those around the fire in the courtyard, possibly made up of both temple servants and temple officials who are kind of waiting to hear about what's happening on the inside. They're curious too. They're waiting. And in the midst of that, some of them were part of this arresting detachment that went, right? The Jewish officials that went to arrest Jesus. They're saying, you're not one of them, are you? Same tone, more of an assertion and accusation than a question. And here we see the third response, okay? So Peter denies Jesus again and again. Starting at the end of 25, he denied it and said, I am not. One of the servants of the high priest, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off, asked, did I not see you in the garden with him? Peter again denied it, and at once a rooster crowed. Okay, so first, it's a group of people asking Peter the question. Maybe One questioner asks it on behalf of all of them. They're all kind of looking at each other. Maybe they're all kind of rapid fire asking it, but the group petitions him at first for an answer. Okay. Some of them, again, perhaps temple officials, right? And now, secondly, it's a relative of the guy who had his ear cut off, which, you know, likely amplifies Peter's denial even further because he's clearly not yet known to them. Like, recognizes the guy who cut the ear off, but they're putting the pieces together. Yeah, didn't I see you there? And this is the cousin of the guy, right? So like, I mean, I know it would be for me, but surely you can imagine the fear and denials, like, growing and growing with each question that's being asked of Peter. The fear of being identified with Jesus. The consequences he's going to face as a result of this. So that's the line of questioning. First round, second round, third round. But let's ask two quick questions about the text to put this all together. First, why the back and forth like this? John doesn't actually write like this in too many other places in the narrative. Why does John, in other words, first describe a scene of the outer courtyard, tell only half or really even a third of that story, like Peter gets through the gate and that's kind of where, you know, denies, the first denial, sees the charcoal fire with the people, and then pssst, inside to Jesus, telling what's happening there, and then pssst, back outside to tell the rest of the story. Why that back and forth in the narrative? Okay. Surely, right, Peter could have just told, John could have just told Peter's story and then told Jesus' story. And that's what he appears to do in other places in the text. So why does he do it this way? Well, probably he's doing his best to reconstruct a couple of things. In a less significant way, but still I think pretty significant, I think he's doing his best to reconstruct the timing. And that's pretty powerful. Like, these two things are happening at the exact same time. Like, Peter's denial in this way and Jesus' denial of nothing. Like, Peter's fear and Jesus' faithfulness are happening at this exact same moment. And so I think, just like when you're watching a movie and there's two things happening in the movie, in an action movie, side by side, you know, it doesn't just usually tell, like, all of this story and then say, now you need to know what happened at the same, you know, like, it's going back and forth between, like, what the characters are experiencing at the exact same time. And so I think John is writing, in part, I think, for this reason. But still, he could have done that. He could have just said what happened to Peter and then said, while this was happening, you know, show the story of what happened with Jesus. So why? Well, centrally, I think, it's because it further reinforces the main point he's making, which is this contrast, this Christ-centered contrast. Here we have a dramatic contrast between Jesus and Peter, a gospel contrast. So Raymond Brown, in his magisterial two-volume work, The Death of the Messiah, it's a classic, but he says it this way. He says, John has constructed a dramatic contrast wherein Jesus stands up to his questioners and denies nothing. So you see where I get some of the language from the outline. Jesus stands up to his questioners and denies nothing, while Peter cowers before his questioners and denies everything. Do you see the contrast, right? But listen, there's a way that you could approach this, and it could be moralism. You know, you could be like, yeah, so moral of the story is, don't be like Peter, be like Jesus, okay? But there's a problem here, because, like, we read texts like this, and we want to identify with the hero of the story. In reality, in Peter, we see ourselves. That's the point of the narrative, that in the discipleship failure, we see ourselves. We're not Jesus in the text. We're Peter in the text. So what we see is really this, and this is the central theme, I think, in John's account. But what we see is essentially one gospel contrast. Our fear and faithlessness is contrasted with Christ's courage and complete faithfulness. So that's what, look, this is what we're meant to see when we read these accounts. Like, man, I see continually as I read through everything that's been occurring in John's gospel. Every time I see discipleship failure happening in John's gospel, I see repeatedly, man, that's my fear, that's my faithlessness, that's my inability, and that's Christ's courage, complete faithfulness despite my faithlessness. And that leads us to a second question that we asked at the front end. How could Peter jump so dramatically from getting in front of Jesus with a dagger, cutting off the servant's ear, to denying Jesus in the courtyard before a servant girl? You know, like, you know, one is like Roman army, and the other is like a servant girl who's very likely much younger than he is, you know. Okay. Whoa, this just is, it seems like such a 180. And the answer is, in both cases, both seemingly extreme examples, boldness, apparent boldness, and denial, in both cases, Peter's thinking ultimately of himself. You know, and I want you to hear me out. He's attempting in the first response, perhaps to prove something to Jesus, believing that he could be good enough to contribute and earn something by way of his efforts. He's attempting in his first response to begin the thing that he thinks Jesus should have come to do for him, which was wage war against the nations and defeat them so that they could no longer have the yoke of Roman oppression over them, right? Like, he's doing it for him. The second response, in terms of his denial, is also obviously something he's doing for himself. He's distancing himself from the public shame that now Jesus, you know, now that Jesus did not seemingly back his play in the garden, like, you know, Peter jumps out with that dagger and it's like, come on, you know, like, I think there's a sense of, Jesus, you're going to help out? Like, here we go, you just knocked them all down with this word that you spoke. So are you, and you know, and Jesus goes bound. And so now, Peter, seeing that, got to look out for number one here. And he denies Jesus, and the rooster crows in the midst of this charcoal fire, and everything Jesus says comes flooding back to him. Now, there's some irony here. There's irony in the text. Why? Because listen, Peter's concerned about the consequences of his actions. So he denies them. He denies his actions. He's so concerned with the consequences of his actions that he denies them. Oh, that was me. I didn't do it. No, I wasn't with Jesus. So Peter is outside, concerned about the consequences of actions, so he denies them. Meanwhile, Jesus is inside, dealing with the consequences of Peter's action, sin, so that Peter doesn't have to. Do we see this? Like, this is where we see how Christians grow, how we become more like Jesus. Not by heaving the weight of law upon ourselves in an effort to prove ourselves to God, you know, flinging daggers meaninglessly and cutting off ears like we talked about last week. But also not deciding that it doesn't matter how we respond and just doing what is easiest for us. Instead, we're to approach the gospel accounts like this. Okay, so our tendency is to approach these accounts and like, it's like what I said, like, what's the moral of the story? Peter didn't do the right thing. Jesus did the right thing. I do the right thing. I avoid the wrong thing. When we approach the gospel accounts, we do it like this. My fear and faithlessness in this text is contrasted with Christ's courage and complete faithfulness. So I am unable on my own strength, but he was perfectly able in obedience. So now through him at work in me, I can be obedient also. Not perfectly so until he comes again to make all things right, or until the other side, until eternity. But I can grow in obedience. I'm free to grow in obedience. Let me say it another way. Okay, so Thune and Walker have this helpful grid in the gospel-centered life that we've looked at together a lot here, that shows how we approach every area of failure of weakness, of failure and weakness. So it's like, if you're going through something as a Christian, you're like, man, I'm having a really hard time obeying X, or like, even if you think you're having an easy time, right? It's like, it's important for us to apply all commands in this way, especially as we approach the gospels. And it's like this, it starts this way. Number one, God says, bear witness about me. So we're commanded throughout the scriptures to bear witness about Jesus, to not deny him. Okay? There's a command here. And commands are important. You know, the relativist would deny this. The moralist says, yep, God says bear witness about me. We're commanded. And so, like, it validates something that the moralist thinks a lot, which is that we need to obey. That we need to follow the rules, okay? Which is true. There are commands that we need to take seriously. But then number two, I cannot obey this command, right? So the first thing we say is God says, bear witness about me. There's a command. Secondly, I cannot obey. And now we have something that the moralist is going to wrinkle his nose at, because he's going to think, oh, I can obey. I do a better job than others at obeying. Right? So the moralist wrinkles his nose, but maybe the relativist is like, yep, can't obey, so why obey? Command doesn't really matter, you know? But God says, you know? So the relativist can't, like, say it doesn't matter. So what do we do? Okay, well, number three, Jesus did obey. He obeyed this perfectly. Like, we can point, and this is where we approach the gospel counsel, and we see, like, countless examples through the gospels, as well as the scriptures as a whole, in which Jesus bears perfect witness. He does not deny the truth of who he is. He does not deny his disciples. He does not deny his Father. He does it perfectly, so that while we're fearful and faithless, he's courageous and completely faithful. Jesus did obey. And he obeyed centrally where? At the cross. He obeyed his Father going to the cross on our behalf, that we might know him and be known by him because of his completed work, throwing ourselves on his mercies. Jesus did obey. And therefore, number four, because Jesus obeyed, because he obeyed the law perfectly and now lives in me, and because I am accepted by God through him, I am now free to obey this command by his grace and power at work within me. It's not like, because Jesus obeyed, it doesn't matter for me. It's like, no, because Jesus obeyed the law perfectly and now lives in me, I'm able. Why? It's like, you are crucified with Christ. Therefore, you no longer live, but Jesus Christ now lives in you. It's his power at work in you. It's his grace at work in you. And his grace has an effect. Martin Luther, you know, we're saved by grace alone, but grace that saves is never alone. It always comes with work. It always comes with, like, a heart affection, a desire change to do that which we're called to do. And you can apply this, by the way, to everything, to every issue. It's like the gospel grid of dealing with, you know, lying. And that's the one that Thune and Walker use in gospel-centered life. You know, God says, don't lie. Do not lie. You know, we're commanded by him not to lie. I can't obey this command because by nature of my sin, I'm a liar. Like, I'm not a truth teller. In my own strength, I'm gonna distort the truth. So I can't obey, but Jesus did obey this perfectly, and we can see countless examples in which he always bears truth, even in the text that we read this morning. Because Jesus obeyed the law perfectly and now lives in me, because I'm accepted by God through him, I am now freed to tell the truth. Like, I don't have to worry about, like, maybe I should lie in order to gain the approval of others, because I have perfect approval from Jesus. So now I'm free to say what's true, knowing it's not going to affect my standing with God. I can always speak truth, you know, so I'm free to speak truthfully, not because of me, but because of a changed heart through the gospel. So we can apply anything to this grid, and we see here how this contrast helps us as believers. It helps us as believers centrally to live in accordance with the gospel instead of either moralism, where we try to earn his favor, or license, where we throw out all of his commands. Neither one will do. Instead, we look at what he's done for us that we could never do for ourselves, so that we can grow in his likeness, because it's his work, not ours. So let's pray that that kind of gospel growth would continue in us here at Gospel Life Church. Lord, thank you for your word, which is active not only in showing us truth and convicting our hearts, but also growing us in your grace, helping us to become more and more like you each day. Help us to encourage one another with these words. In Jesus' name, amen.